Hi, this is Stephen Piercy from Rat. You're listening to Iron City Rocks.
Hi, this is Udo Dirkschneider, the singer of UDO, and you're listening to Iron City Rocks.
Hi, this is Blackie Lawless from Wasp, and you're listening to Iron City Rocks.
Hello and welcome to episode 543 of the Iron City Rocks podcast. I'm your host John, coming to you from the Iron City of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, bringing you the best rock, hard rock, heavy metal, and blues talk on the net. Episode 543, we are very pleased to welcome back to the show for the second time. We have Mr. Blackie Lawless of Wasp coming to us to talk about the show they're going to be doing at Stage AE on November 20th here in Pittsburgh. And we are also joined, I believe for the second time as well, by Mr. Joey Vera of Armored Saint, who will be direct support for Wasp that night. So we're giving you the full rundown of the Wasp Armored Saint show. So instead of listening to me talk, let's listen to a little bit of Wasp. We'll get into the interview with Blackie, and you stick around at the end. We'll give you details on how you can enter to win a pair of tickets to this show.
Yeah.
Rocks. We have on the line Blackie Lawless of Wasp. How you doing, Blackie?
Hi, sir. I'm good. How are you?
I am doing fantastic. Thank you for joining us once again. We had a chance to speak probably a year and a half ago before you guys rolled into Greensburg for what turned out to be a phenomenal sold-out show. I don't think we could have got more people in there if we wanted. Coming back around now, which is awesome to see you guys again. I think when everybody saw you the last time, we all jumped on it because we weren't sure how frequent you'd be doing this. But you're back now in 2024 with an amazing show with the likes of Death Angel and Support. This time, correct me if I'm wrong, you're focusing a little more on the first album, it's this 40th anniversary. Is that correct?
Well, it's the first album in its entirety, but the show will be done in two halves. It'll be the first album from beginning to end in chronological order, the way it is on the record, and then we'll come back and we'll do a second part of the show, which is like a best of.
Okay.
So, this is something that we've not done since the very first tour that we did. So there's songs, like I said, that we haven't played for 40 years. So it's fun because for the last couple of years, the themes have been around, where we started. And it's nice to go back and look at this and, you realize that, most bands, they made their bones the first 5 years they're together, and we were no different.
Sure.
And, you go back and you look at where you started, and you realize there's a reason you had success. Because we move on, we grow, we mature, all those things happen. But, when you put distance between it, it's like you go back and you look at it, it's like looking at somebody that you used to know.
Right.
But it's very different. But like I said, it's a fun place to be able to go back and visit.
For a fan, when I go back and I listen to this album, I remember where I was, what I was doing. And some of it is just a fantastic album. And some of it, quite honestly, is nostalgia. For you as a musician, do you get nostalgic? Do you have that kind of luxury with your own music?
When we did the last tour, we played one of the songs we did in the very beginning of the show was The Flame. And we had not done that song for 40 years. I forgot how good that song really was. I had a ball playing that song every night. Probably for me, it was the highlight of the show. So to answer your question, yes. Because like I said, just a moment ago, you forget.
Yeah.
A lot of water is under the bridge, a lot of records, a lot of songs, a lot of tours, and it's easy to get really lost in the shuffle, and you're the one doing it.
Yeah.
Because you live in a bubble, you don't see it like the fan base does. So to have something like that, to be able to go back and revisit it, it's a shock to the senses, but in a good way.
Yeah.
Because you got to remember, any artist, I don't care who it is, when you make a record, you never get to hear it for the first time like somebody else does. I mean, think back to wherever you might have been when some landmark record in your life you heard for the first time. You remember where you were, the scenario, all that stuff, when you heard that first album. The artist that makes it never gets that.
Right.
We get other things, we get privy to little inside things that happen inside the studio, everything that surrounds the making of, you're privileged to be able to witness all of that, and that is very cool. But I, as a fan, remember where I was when I heard record XYZ or whatever, and those are life-changing moments. And like I said, as an artist, you get robbed of that.
Being that this was your first album, did you get much say from the record company at the time on the singles and what order they released? Obviously, I Want to Be Somebody was, kind of perfectly placed where it was. But a song like The Flame, for example, which 2 years later might have been, when the power ballads really started to kind of fill the airwaves, might have been something that would have exploded. But did you get a lot of say in that, or was this something that, somebody at Capitol just said, here's what you're going to do?
We had a very unusual contract. especially for a new band. We had final say on everything.
Okay.
In other words, we had right of refusal. Very few bands get that, and usually they have to have a long established career. But we had that from the get-go. So anything that we wanted to do ultimately was what we did. And when I say we, I'm talking about in conjunction with our management.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, yes, we would work with a label because you want them to be on your side.
Yeah.
But ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, it was our call.
Yeah, and that's a great point about them being on our side. You don't want to go in there and be so abrasive that they're, you know, you're just to hell with you. We're not going to.
Yeah, it turns everybody off because, you know, it's a business. And when you understand that you're dealing with a record company,
mm-hmm.
they have many other artists who are successful, especially a label like Capitol, you know. And so, you know, at any given point when our first record came out, who are you going up against at that point? You going up against Tina Turner? You going up against Heart, Beach Boys, God forbid, the Beatles?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, you got to make sure you got some allies in there on your side because they've only got X amount of manpower to go around to work records.
Yeah.
And I have seen, we've all seen great records get lost in the shuffle and people go, well, how'd that happen? Because there wasn't enough manpower at a label and they had too many great records they got flooded with at the same moment.
Yeah. Yeah. And we also know when a record company loses interest in an artist, how even a fantastic album can just be buried.
Oh yeah.
I think 1992, that happened to a lot of bands.
It happened to me with The Idol in America.
Yeah.
Not in Europe or the rest of the world, but it happened here in America.
Absolutely, yeah.
But eventually, if it's a good enough record, the public will seek it out.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think that's one of those things that I you know, as a fan took away from the tour that you just completed was, you know, you're walking away going, God, that was, you know, that song XYZ from album ABC was way better than I remembered it or way more than I gave it time, you know. So it's, I think, opens a lot of people to, especially the second half of the show you guys did, you know, was a little, you know, maybe, quote, newer stuff, but, you know, a little past the first three albums to get people back in that kind of groove. On the subject of the last tour, I mean, you guys, and when we spoke, I remember, you know, you had the ideas of what the set was going to look like, and I think it even exceeded what you described it. But taken away from that, were you surprised or obviously somewhat vindicated in the industry's eyes at the turnout for those shows?
No, and I don't say that to sound arrogant,
mm-hmm.
but when you nowadays we have data that we did not have years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're looking at the numbers will tell you exactly what it is. You know, we have, you know, the internet today giveth and taketh away.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is Spotify, Apple, Google, things like that. You can see numbers in certain regions, like whether it's New York, Pittsburgh, Los Angeles, wherever. You can see what songs are getting played where, who's listening to them, and things like that. You can see the number of your fan base, and those represent a significant amount of potential tickets. So when we were dealing with Live Nation initially, we told them, you know, they wanted to put us in venues that we didn't think were going to be right for us, and we held out. They took a chance, to their credit, and it all worked for everybody, you know. But that's because of the strength of that fan base that they maybe had not paid attention to over the years. And, you know, but it ended up, like I said, working for everybody. So it was a win-win at the end of the day.
Now, with that data, you know, it used to be, you know, you would come through and do, you know, you open for Black Sabbath and, you know, at the Syria Mosque in Pittsburgh, and you move X number of units in Pittsburgh in the following weeks. Do you look at those kind of stats now to see, you know, I mean, maybe it doesn't mean it's probably not as lucrative, the numbers in Spotify, but does it give you a sense of, okay, when we were there, we saw X percentage jump in that market, therefore we know we come back, we can expect X plus the next time around?
Well, it's probably like that for most bands. But with us, it was a little backwards. Our numbers, is what got us into those tours to begin with.
Right.
Because to be able to do some of the things that we did early on, we had to have some pretty serious numbers. So it was the advanced sales, and to be quite honest with you, it was, like I said, it was almost like bass ackwards, where, like, you know, we had good numbers going in, which is what got us the gig, and when we would play a ton, yeah, you might see a slight bump, but not as much as you might think, because, like I said, it had already happened.
You'd already reached that fan base.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like I said, it's probably not like that with most bands, but that's certainly the way it was with us.
Yeah, I don't think I knew too many people who were, let's call it casual Wasp fans. You know, I remember.
Yeah,
you
know, I mean, you were either in or you weren't.
Yeah, I remember going to see a band like Kix, and it's not to knock Kix, but I was so blown away with how good they were live that it was okay, I'm going to go and buy that record the next morning.
Good band.
I already had your record before I came to see you. You know, it was probably, you know, a lot. And maybe some of that had to do with the lack of MTV support. Not that, you know, they totally excluded you guys, but, I mean, you weren't spun as much as a Poison or a Winger or, you know, some of the bands that maybe were a little
that
more.
That would happen
mainstream.
Later, though. You know, those bands didn't come out till like, 87, 88. You know, you got to remember, we were 83, 84, 85.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we were part of that first wave.
Yeah, it was certainly, and that certainly made a big difference, I think, is, you know, you guys were, you know, you were right.
Plus, we were dominating magazines at that point, too, you know, so there was a lot of where we were getting our push from.
Yeah, you can't understate, you know, the effect that someone like Mark Weiss had on your band. You certainly got to, you know, and that was part of what made it cool. It was almost the same thing that drew, you know, us to Metallica, was you would open a Circus or Hit Parade or whatever, and you would see you there with, you know, Raw Meat, or, you know, you'd see these things about Metallica and be like, where do I go to hear these guys? I just got to go buy the record. And that's what we did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, okay, I'm going to go get, you know, the debut album or which, you know, Electric Circus or whatever. And then it was like, damn, this is really good. You know, as opposed to the rest of us that were kind of spoon-fed, you know, obviously Quiet Riot, Motley Crue got the rotation.
Right.
You guys didn't. You guys had the visuals, though. For this tour, as far as the production, I mean, obviously you had invested quite a bit. I'm sure that was a bit of a gamble the last time around. Should we expect something on that scale this time around?
Bigger. And I don't say that, you know, nonchalantly. We're attempting to make this show a combination of the first album cover and the first live show. We're trying to blend them both together so when you walk in the room, you know, you got to remember there's a lot of people that didn't experience it up close and personal the first time. And I don't want them to just walk in and experience what they think it was. I want to take them back to what it actually was. For a moment, for a couple hours that they're there, I want them to walk in that room and think that somehow magically the clock got turned back. I want them to experience what 1984 was like for real by a band who was there doing it. And what we did on the last tour with the kind of like the carnival atmosphere, you know, I told my tour manager, you know, I said, I want people, when they walk in the room, I want them to smell the sawdust.
Yeah.
So what we did is, when we first started 40 years ago, you know, you saw bands use fog machines and things like that. Well, you had two kinds. They were either dry ice based,
right,
or they were oil based. And the oil based fog machines smelled really, really bad. But nowadays, the science has progressed to the point where we can get fog juice in different flavors now.
Gotcha.
And one of the flavors that had just come out, when I say flavors, what we smell on stage, you can get it in vanilla, you can get it in strawberry, cherry, things like that, and it makes it a lot better. Well, a couple of the things that would just come out just as we were getting ready to do the tour 2 years ago was the flavor of cotton candy. And what I told my tour manager is I wanted to start literally spritzing the room with popcorn was one flavor and cotton candy was the other. So when people walked in the room, it didn't it wasn't like a massive wave that hit them, but you know, smell is a very, very, very potent thing.
Yeah.
You know, in this particular case, it can be used to stimulate memory.
Yeah.
And when they were walking in the room, they may not have even realized what was going on because it was subconscious. But when you saw, you know, when we came out and you saw those, you know, sideshow and circus banners and things mm-hmm. like that, it all helped to create the illusion that not you weren't just watching something, you were in it.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to do with this one, to make you feel like you are actually in it. So it's a challenge to put a show like that together. And in the second half of the show, we'll have the circus banners and things like that again. We're going to do it a little bit different this time, but when I say it's bigger than it was last time, it is literally twice the size of what it was last time.
I think the anticipation has got to be a little bit bigger, too, for those who saw it, because, you know, we're like, okay, this is what a rock show can be and what used to be.
You know, one of the things we kept hearing, and I didn't really think about it because we hadn't been in America in a long time, but, you know, people were saying to us, we don't see this anymore. And I thought about it, and I thought, yeah, they're probably right. You know, but that's not the way we've been doing it in the rest of the world. And we wanted to, when we came back home, when we came back and played the U.S., we wanted people to see what the rest of the world's been seeing for a while.
Yeah, I think as you're talking, I'm just going back and I'm in my head, I'm seeing the Live at the Lyceum VHS, which, you know, mm-hmm. in my house got a ton. Mm-hmm. Just one question on that. When you guys decided to do that, was that was pretty cutting edge at the time. There weren't a ton of, you know, full-on concert home videos at the time. Who kind of made that call, and did it pay off bigger than you expected?
Well, that was really our manager, Rod Smallwood, because Rod was managing Maiden at the time, and Maiden were not yet what they would eventually become. I mean, both of us were, Maiden had a couple of records before us, but we were both pretty much startups.
Mm-hmm.
But because Maiden had done a couple of records already, the contact for Sony Music, which is the people that released it, that contact was already there. And it was something that too ended up being mutually beneficial for them and us, because you know, it sold really well, and you know, all those things, you know, help solidify, you know, a band's position, their legacy, the folklore, all those things, you know. So, you know, if you can capture some magic, you know, on film, it's there forever.
Yeah,
and we were fortunate enough to be able to do that.
Yeah, and the other thing, that was another product where it was like too young to actually be allowed to go to the show, but clever enough to get a copy at a record store to see the show, even though you weren't allowed to go to the show. So, again, as a geeky fan, that was a fantastic, you know, it wasn't a memento of a show, it was the only chance I get to see it.
Well, that's all part of the reason what I'm saying. You know, we're not trying to, we're doing this now, we're not trying to just put on a show for you. We're trying to create an experience where you feel like you are genuinely back, where the year gets turned back to 1984, where you see the authenticity of what it was genuinely like.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not easy to do, because, like I said, there's a whole bunch of psychological things that'll go on that the audience really doesn't even need to be aware of.
Yeah.
Because it strips away the beauty of the simplicity, and if you do that, then you've kind of, you know, you've told everybody the punchline of the joke, you know, so you don't want to do that. You just want them to have a good time and to walk away with that emotional experience of what it was really like.
Oh, fantastic. Blackie, I want to thank you so much for your time today. Again, you guys are going to be in November 20th with Death Angel and On to Others in Support. That'll be a magnificent night at Stage AE. I want to thank you so much and wish you safe travels into Pittsburgh until then.
All right, John. Look after yourself, bud, and we hope to see you when we get there.
Iron Maiden return the Future Past Tour 2024, PPG Paints Arena, Friday, November 8th, 2024, featuring songs from their latest chart-topping album, Senjutsu, and the classic Somewhere in Time. Get tickets now at Ticketmaster.com. Don't miss the thrilling spectacle of Iron Maiden live.
Heard a big thank you to Blackie Lawless for coming on and joining us and talking about the show again. They're going to be performing the entire debut album at the show on the 20th. And in direct support of them, Armored Saint. Armored Saint also opened for them when they were in Greensburg on the last time through Pittsburgh. Armored Saint put on a blistering show, if you recall. If you were there, John Bush was fighting an illness and still sounded amazing. So we talked with Joey Vera in this interview about primarily working on follow-up material to Punching the Sky, their 2020 album. We also talk about the new single they released called One Chain, Don't Make No Prison. So we get into a great deal of detail for that. So I'll save that for the interview. We're going to play you some Armored Saint live here, and we'll get right into the interview with Joey Vera.
Between me and Sadini in the sky, whether my heart is good, it's good. We'll be right back.
Right, ladies and gentlemen, my pleasure to welcome to Iron City Rocks. We have on the line from Armored Saint and Fates Warning, we have Joey Vera on the line. How you doing, Joey?
I'm good. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. You guys are going to be rolling back into the Pittsburgh area. We're delighted to see you were put back on the bill with Wasp as they come in November on the 20th. You're playing a show in the downtown Pittsburgh this time. Last time you were in Greensburg, so it's going to be great to see you guys again in a slightly larger venue than the theater you were in the last time. When we saw you, they told us John was sick, but having been at that show, I don't know who the hell could tell. The man could sing. I think you guys actually had to postpone a few of those dates after you were here. But kind of wanted to check in with you guys. I know you have a new single out that you put out earlier in the summer, cover of One Chain, Don't Make No Prisoner, or Prison, I'm sorry. Just wanted to see what you guys had going on. Were you working on a full-length album with that, or was that just a decision to kind of go the singles route?
Well, the answer is yes to both. We have been writing a new record. have about, I don't know, 7 songs in at this point.
Okay.
We just kind of came up with this idea to do a recording of this song, and it really was born out of, like, to be quite honest, it was born out of just something that was done for fun, and it was something that I did. I demoed the song myself, and then I the backstory is that I'm a huge fan of the Four Tops and old school R&B in general, and so is John Bush for that matter, and some of the other guys as well. We're big fans of 70s soul, R&B, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So this is one of my favorite tracks from this band, and I always heard it as like a rock song to me. It sounded like a really heavy rock song. So I just thought, like, wouldn't it be fun to hear John Bush singing over this tune? So I told him about it, and he said, well, that sounds like a great idea. But so I made this demo, you know, and I, you know, put heavy guitars on it and made it a metal song, basically. And so he flipped out. He came over to my house and we demoed the song. And this was really, again, no intention really for Armored Saint. It was more like Tim and I just having banter and forth.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it came out so good that we showed it to the rest of the guys and we go, this is so awesome. Like, how fun would it be to just do this? And then this idea came up with Metal Blade about just releasing a single, just digital only. Mm-hmm. A lot of contemporary newer artists do this. It's not something we grew up with being old school guys.
Yeah.
But the kids these days, they're doing crazy stuff. So artists release singles all the time. So we just figured, you know what? It's not like, you know, it's not so alien to do this. So let's just do a single. So we did a single, made a video for it with Dave Brodsky, is a great director friend of ours, and it came out really, really cool. It's a really fun thing, and so we just released it as a single. So that isn't really, it's not really intentional. It's not intended to end up on the record per se. I'm not saying that it won't or it will, but it wasn't really intended for that. So in the meantime, we are writing. We're currently writing at the moment, and we have about 7 songs or so that are done, and we still continue to write. And the plan is to try to get into the studio in the spring of 25. So, yeah, we've been really busy lately.
Yeah. As you're talking, I'm trying to think of John singing Reach Out, I'll Be There, or Can't Help Myself, or some of those songs. I think guys could do like a moonlighting gig.
He's such a great bluesy singer that he just fits perfectly with all that stuff.
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing when you think about the, you know, band like the Four Tops or a lot of those bands from the mid-60s into the 70s, the single was really, you know, the 45 was its own entity. You know, people didn't necessarily, you know, I defy a lot of, you know, people of that era to even say what album some of the songs were on. You know, they had the 45, they might know what the B-side was, but, you know, maybe it's just coming full circle. Love the image you guys did with the suits. That was a fun twist.
Yeah. So it was just for fun. We try not to take ourselves too serious, you know, and And we just had fun with it.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing, because you don't think, like, you know, I've always kind of put you guys as a very traditional metal band, and it's kind of fun to see that, you know, artists having fun. You know, you guys were you know, straight ahead metal. You know, so there's some room for levity there. That's kind of cool.
Exactly.
When it comes to the new material, I know you guys you just done a live record. Would we expect something, you know, to be similar to Punching the Sky, which was a fantastic album? Or yeah, obviously the last 4 years has given you guys plenty of material to write about. I mean, frankly, the world never ceases to give you song ideas. But
yeah,
do you
true.
Know, the songs kind of newer songs, or are these some of the things maybe you go back in the bag and, you know, we had this from La Raza, you know, here was a riff we had written and we kind of formed into a new song? Or how do you approach that, putting new stuff together?
Mostly it's new stuff, and it's, you know, our records have always been sort of a time stamp as to where we were at the time of the writing and the time of the recording of them.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result of that, we've had this sort of trend of not making the same record twice. I'm not sure that's totally intentional, but I'm actually really happy that that's if that's an accident, that's a happy accident.
Amen.
For me, I would hate to feel like, as an artist, that we're just repeating ourselves over and over and over again. I don't really think we've really done that. But every record, like I said, kind of is on its own island.
Right.
Thankfully, our fans have followed us through those different islands and the traveling of all that. Mm-hmm. And I think for the most part, our goal is always the same, and that's really just to write really great songs. And again, it's indicative of where we are at the time of the writing of that. So,
right.
You know, I would never say that this is a there are whatever record we're making is a continuation of anything previous to that. I mean, I always acknowledge that, I like to, advocate and kind of show off some of the things that we have done in the past and that I think that we're good at with mm-hmm. relations to things like grooves or rhythms or just feelings in general of certain aspects of the music. I like repeating myself in that sense,
right?
But because I think we have this lineage that is constant all the way through our records, but at the same time, there's always room for stretching out a little bit, taking some chances, growing, you know, just getting better as a songwriter and trying different things. So, yeah, you know, there's thematically, there's a lot of things to talk about and write about,
yeah.
Lyrically, which has happened in the last 4 to 6 years. So there'll be a lot of that. I will say that, you know, the only thing that really it's sort of been on the forefront of my mind as one of the songwriters is that trying to kind of keep things a little more focused mm-hmm. and a little less, you know, we've written a lot of long songs in the past.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to sort of edit myself a little bit more and try to get to the point quicker. But other than that, you know, everything's fair game with me. So, well, most of the things are all brand new. There's a couple of things that I pulled out from like old riffs I had from like years ago. Like I'm talking like 10, 15 years ago that never saw the light of day. And I'm like, hey, this was kind of cool. Like, why didn't I ever use this? You know? And so I just kind of rework it and massage it. And it feels different now than it did 15 years ago. So, it's kind of transformed into something else. So it's a little bit of a mix of that, but mostly the stuff is just stuff that's sort of come up recently.
Mm-hmm. Do you write when you're, especially when you're alone, do you write on bass or do you write with a guitar?
I only write on guitar.
Okay.
I never write on bass. I started out playing guitar when I was younger before I switched to bass.
Mm-hmm.
so I'm a closet guitar player. But I've only done writing on guitar, and you know, the idea I have, my phone is full of these ideas that just, if I'm just sitting around tinkling away in front of the TV, you know, and mm-hmm. I'll just turn on my voice memo and,
yeah,
and record a little ditty, and it's usually like 15 seconds long, and then I have hundreds of these things, and so I tend to have to sit down and say, all right, it's a very arduous task, but I have to say to myself, okay, sit down and weed through all this sketching you did
right.
for the past year and a half and see if there's anything worth pursuing. And that's currently what I'm doing at the moment.
It's probably better than the days you had to do that with the Tascam or the FosTech. So at least technology's made it a little bit easier to do that.
Yeah, a lot easier, for sure. A lot easier.
The when you write, do you, aside from like the voice memo, do you ever like sit down and kind of utilize something like Pro Tools in the writing process, like giving yourself, you know, maybe you lay down a guitar piece and then it allows you to kind of think independently of maybe what a melody would be like, or what your bass line would be like, or do you need that as a songwriting tool or utilize it in any way?
I don't really do that much. I usually have to have a better head start before I get into Pro Tools.
Mm-hmm.
That's just me. I know some people, you know, create a drum beat or something,
yeah,
and then they write to the drum beat. And that's, it's not that I've never done that, but I very rarely do that. Mostly it comes from writing, sitting in front of the TV or sitting outside in the backyard with my guitar, and then something gets sparked in me, and then I start going down the rabbit hole.
Come from a lyric first, or do you tend to?
Not for me. I mean, not musically, not when I'm writing music. It very rarely comes from a lyric.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times I get inspired by something I hear in background music in movies or on TV shows, or sometimes a commercial. Sometimes it's just like, it's like 10 seconds of something, and then it haunts me. It's like, it's such a weird thing, but I'd never forget that 10 seconds. I have no idea what song it is or
mm-hmm.
where it came from or who it is or something, but it just sparks this little thing. And then I will reinterpret that in a completely upside down way. It's not that I'm ripping off something, mm-hmm. but it's more like, I don't know, it's like somebody shows you the color red next mm-hmm. to the color orange.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go, wow, that does something to me. And then I take that red and orange and I go over to a different canvas and I rearrange those two colors to make something different. That's sort of similar to doing something like that as a painter might do, but
right.
You know, it comes from a lot of different places, and that's one way that it comes to me.
Is it hard as a musician? I've often wondered, you know, we all have influences. You mentioned the Four Tops, whatever it is, you know, let's say you're listening to Deicide, whatever. And you get on a little bit of a kick and you're listening to it, to not let that bleed into what you're currently writing, to still be, you know, a Joey Vera composition, as opposed to letting your influences bleed in too much. Is that hard for you to do? I notice when I sit down to play, if I'm listening to Social Distortion for a week or so, I'll sit down and I start sounding like Mike Ness, which I'm thankful for, but
yeah,
it's not, you know, I'm seeing red and orange and painting in red and orange. You know, is that something you had to kind of train yourself to not let it influence what you're doing too much?
Well, I actually feel the opposite lately, that I've gotten older. I have no problem admitting, and I think I've been pretty blatant about it at times, about what my influences are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I would never directly rip something off, but I have no shame in saying, oh yeah, I was inspired by this song by Thin mm-hmm. Lizzy,
yeah,
or I was inspired by this song by Bad Company, or I was inspired by this song by Motorhead, or whatever, or Opeth, you know,
yeah.
I mean, I've been inspired by Opeth in the last 15 years, and it's rubbed off, I think, in some of the stuff I've written. Maybe it's not that obvious to people, but
that's, I think, the key is when you listen to it, to the listener, I don't necessarily sense it. Maybe if I sat down and listened to, you know, one of their albums, one of your albums, side, you know, back to back, something like that. But I think that might be what separates you from me, is that you're able to do it, and it's not so blatant, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it does take work to do that. I mean, I've been, you know, there's been a few times where I've written something and then I'm like, that's way too close, you know.
Yeah.
But let's take it apart and put it back together so that it's not so close. But I don't have a problem with letting my influences show. That's just me personally. You know, I don't have this. When I was much younger, it was all about, you know, it was all about like proving yourself, kind of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we were always out to prove that we were original, you know, totally original. This is our stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And then you start overthinking things once you start doing that. I don't know. I just think that like our trajectory has really come over time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that we've really settled into our own sort of voice, if you will, until sometime between 2000 and 2010, when La Raza came out. Mm-hmm. That period of time was a sort of a relaxation period emotionally for us, I think. And we were able to say, you know what? Enough with trying to keep up with the Joneses. Stop looking over your shoulder. This is our thing. We've been doing our thing since day one. We're on our own island. It's fine. This is where we are. And this is us. And like, no expectations, no big hurdles to get over, no pressure, be who we are. And so there's a lot of freedom that came with that. So I think that, I think that's helped as being a songwriter.
Does it help that, you know, that period of time probably coincided with the fact that, you know, it wasn't reasonable to think you were going to put out triple platinum records, you know, to kind of take that, you know, producing a commodity isn't really an issue anymore. You know, you're just more of an artist at that point.
It's a good point, because when we were coming up, you know, maybe young people don't know this necessarily, but when we came up in the early 80s, but mm-hmm. by the time the mid to late 80s were in full swing, like this mm-hmm. commodity, as you put it, called heavy metal, was massive. And it was, there was so much money being thrown around by the record labels and promoters, and just so much money was spent on this commodity. And we got a taste of that. We got signed to a major label in 84. So we got the giant recording budgets, you know, like 500 grand, like for your first album. It's like, who does that? You know, no one anymore.
No one now. Yeah.
So at the time, you know, that was the thing. It was like, you had to keep up with that, you know, and there was a lot of pressure keeping up with that all the way until the early 90s.
Yeah.
When things started to change, you know, then the whole commodity went over to the grunge era,
mm-hmm.
The grunge, you know, genre and other genres. Hip hop became a big commodity too.
Sure.
So like, you know, then the pressure, once you alleviate all that stuff, like you don't have those big pressures anymore, the big mm-hmm. money being spent on you and people breathing down your neck and trying to control you. It makes things a lot easier.
Yeah. I have to assume, right about raising fear, you guys had a lot of cooks in the kitchen, whether you wanted it or not, you know, from labels and management. And, you know, you guys were, you know, in an era where, you know, every album was expected to go double platinum. And, you know, and there are some great albums. I don't want to say that everybody just made cookie cutter records in that era, but
no,
you know, a lot of bands, you know, kind of succumbed to the pressures of, you know, the A&R guy you know, this isn't the right single. This isn't the right look. Why don't you guys change your sound, become more commercial? So I imagine, you know, by the time you made, you know, Revelation, the expectations are different. Pressures are different. Little less, you don't have to second guess everything quite as much, and you can just be Armored Saint, you know, and the fans who loved the band in 88, 87, you know, there weren't a lot of casual Armored Saint fans, you know, like Wasp, you know, this, you either really got it and you loved it, or that wasn't your thing. You know, you guys were the flavor of the month, which I think is maybe why you're, you know, you guys are able to still do this. You know,
people, it's probably true.
You know, it certainly helped, because a lot of bands that, you know, did that kind of work in the 80s weren't able to, you know, continue. So, Joey, I want to thank you so much for the time today. I don't want to keep you too long. You guys will be here in November with Wasp, doing a show for us, and we will look forward to new music from you guys relatively soon. Hopefully some more Four Tops. or maybe get into the Platters. You know, I don't want to throw out any suggestions. Yeah, the skies are endless. I would love to hear some Earth, Wind, and Fire, if that's not too new for you guys. But
oh man, no, we're huge Earth, Wind, and Fire fans.
So that's thank great. You so much, Joey. We'll see you in about a month, man.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me, and I'll look forward to seeing everybody out there. Cheers.
All right, again, a giant thank you to Joey Vera, Armored Saint, Blackie Lawless of Wasp. Again, they will both be in town, Stage AE, November 20th, the show. Tickets are available now. But if you stuck around, I promised you a chance to enter to win. If you visit IronCityRocks.com and go to episode 543 and click on the show link, there will be an entry form for you to fill out. We will give one lucky winner a pair of tickets to see the show. There will be a passcode you need to enter. The passcode is Tormentor, one of the tracks on Wasp's debut album, Tormentor. So enter that in the form. Have a chance to win. We invite you to do that as soon as possible. We'll have all the details on when you need to enter by on the site as well. So check that out. Appreciate you listening. Also, while you're there, there are 542 previous podcasts, if this is your first, to check out if you like this kind of music. Also, we're on social media, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, you name it, are all Iron City Rocks. And you can drop us an email at ironcityrocks@gmail.com. Let us know what kind of bands you're interested in, artists you'd like to hear on the show in the future, artists you're tired of hearing. We'll take it all, the good and the bad. Love to hear from everybody who takes the time, so don't hesitate. Again, thank you so much for listening, and check out Wasp and Armored Saint on November 20th at Stage AE.